On This Week in Enterprise Tech, is Google trying to float your data? Netgear has a hole in their data boat and all about identity management. Quiet on the set.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for This Week in Enterprise Tech is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is TWiT, This Week in Enterprise Tech, episode 64, recorded October 28th, 2013. Identity Management, Part 1. This Week in Enterprise Tech is brought to you by RingCentral. We do everything in the cloud. That's why I love my cloud-based phone system by RingCentral. Zero startup costs and RingCentral is $20 per month per user. Try it now with a 30-day risk-free trial and buy one desk phone and get a second phone free, up to 20 phones. Call 800-543-9980 or visit ringcentral.com and use our promo code TWIT. Welcome to TWiT, This Week in Enterprise Tech. It's the show dedicated to the enterprise professional, the IT pro, and the geek who just wants to know how the world is connected. I'm your host, Father Robert Ballasaire, the digital Jesuit, your guide to all things in the enterprise. And of course, I am joined by an all-star cast, my dear co-hosts, starting with Mr. Brian Chi, the director of the Advanced Network Computing Laboratory in Honolulu, Hawaii. Brian, thanks for coming back on. Tell us, how are things in the land of the sun?
I'm tired. We have 7,000 screaming kitties here on Friday and Saturday for our biennial open house. It was a lot of fun. We were blowing up stuff. We were making lava flows. And the kids absolutely love the six-axis mouse flying through the sub-ocean mapping system.
So basically, you were showing them all the cool toys you get to play with while sitting on those boats.
Yep, pretty much.
Nice. Well, you know who wasn't on a boat? At least I don't think he was on a boat. Mr. Curtis Franklin from Enterprise Efficiently. Now, Curtis, he's in this special diet where he's actually trying to stay as still as possible in order to conserve energy. So, Curtis, great job. Tell us, how are things going on over on the right coast?
Well, I'm working hard on my Jeff Dunham correspondence ventriloquism course, and I think it's working out all right so far. But aside from that, things are going really well. It's been autumnal here, cooler temps, so things have been going fine. I've got a very special episode of E2 Radio to tell everyone about at the end of the program. Ooh. Hope everyone will stick around for that.
Now, ladies and gentlemen, that is how you do a tease. Now, let's get straight into it because we've got two very interesting enterprise bites. The first one is a story that's been getting kicked around over the weekend, and that's this mysterious floating data center. Maybe that Google has floating in the San Francisco Bay. This was reported on by CNET's Daniel Turteman. There's a large floating structure in the San Francisco Bay Area waters just off of Treasure Island. That's the midway point between Oakland and San Francisco on the Bay Bridge. Now, late last year, somebody started a project within Hangar 3, which is on Treasure Island, which I forgot to ask Jason to get my computer, but if you had my computer right now, I'd be able to show you exactly where it is. Now, this area is, it's a very large, publicly owned piece of land. Now, I'm going to show you exactly where it is. So if you zoom into San Francisco, you're going to find that, and actually you can find this on Google's own servers, it's right about here. Now, the significance of this is in the plain sight of all of Silicon Valley. It takes place within this hangar right here. This is hangar number 3. It's one of the largest structures on Treasure Island, and it has access to this dock. The cool thing about this story is Daniel Turteman did some real old-fashioned reporting to find exactly what was going on, because it seems as if whoever has leased this structure has done some really good work in concealing, in obfuscating what's going on and who is actually contracting, leasing, etc., etc. What he did was find out that the lease was signed by a company called By and Large LLC, which already sounds like a front. It lists Mike Darby and Kenneth Yee as the names on the lease as the company representatives, but when he contacted the former, he denied that he worked for By and Large. The contact name given on the lease is a man by the name of Tim Brandon, and if you call the number that is given on the lease, it plays a pre-recorded message that says, "Welcome to Google. I'm sorry this number has been disconnected." Now, when he broke this story, trying to speak with Tim Brandon changed his LinkedIn so that it no longer says he's a Google employee. This is all the hallmarks of a Google black bag project. In other words, they're doing something that they don't want the public to know about yet. Now, I haven't heard of a Google project that has gone to these lengths. Chibert, Curtis, what about you? We know Google's run some stealth projects before, everything from Gmail to Google Fiber. This seems pretty 007, right?
Yeah, this is fun. Just look at it this way. Treasure Island's actually one of the better places to put it because you still have lots of access to lots of transportation, power, all that kind of good stuff. But the Treasure Island itself is actually limited access, so you can do some interesting things. Hangar 3 actually has a long history of all kinds of black bag projects. In fact, if we ever manage to get Joe Grand onto a Maker Show, he can tell us all about some really cool projects that he pulled off in Hangar 3.
Right. Yeah, Hangar 3 has a long history as a source of black bag projects. Curtis, let me ask you, by and large, is what we know it's a fictitious company because it's a Disney name, right? It's that company that was in WALL-E. It's actually been in a few Disney films as the sort of the nameless mega box type corporation. What do you think Google's trying to do by putting this under such a level of secrecy?
Well, I suspect that what they might well have done is get a decent rate on a lease on that property. You know, living in Florida, that's what Walt Disney Company did when they were putting together all of the property for Disney World. They had a couple of shell corporations that they used that went around and bought things up because they knew that if people got wind of the fact that Walt Disney wanted to buy their property, mysteriously the price would go up. I have a strong suspicion that the same is true when people hear that a deep pockets company like Google is sniffing around real estate in an area.
Yeah. Now, we should note that there is speculation that this is the same barge, the same style of barge that's being built in Portland, Maine. So you've got one on either coast, also run by the By and Large Corporation, also under a veil of secrecy. Now, my question is this. Let's get into the speculation. There's been a lot of people who are saying, well, this is a container idea. The whole, remember, we talked about this on Twit before, the idea of a containerized data center where Google was taking shipping containers, packing them full of servers, making them coolable, making them pluggable for power, and then building up data centers with these self-contained, sort of almost disposable data modules. Turtleman is suggesting that the containers that he saw on some Google satellite photos suggest that they're doing the same thing with this container ship. They are now taking their idea of a containerized data center and moving it to the next level. And that is, why not take containers and put them on a container ship? Now, there are a few advantages to doing this. If you have containers on a container ship on a barge, you have easy access to cooling, which is one of the biggest expenses we know, because you just draw water up from the deep. It's an ocean-going vessel, which means that it can be towed from place to place, anywhere that needs massive data center capabilities. And there's also this interesting idea of being able to power the device off of the tide itself. Not sure about that last one, but Chibert, let me ask you this. If Google has figured out a way to make this work, to actually put a data center on a barge, float it anywhere that's possible, and get cooling essentially for free, what does that do for the ROI? What's the bottom line on being able to get cooling for next to nothing?
There's no such thing as a free lunch. You know, the Honolulu business area is actually trying to pull the same thing off by pulling a pipeline in from the deep ocean and running it through the downtown area for cooling. The problem is you start spending an awful lot of money on stainless steel and things like that just to keep everything from turning into a rust bucket. So it's not free, but it's a hell of a lot cheaper than when you can just use the entire ocean as a heat sink. And it's definitely not new. Like the chat room says, Maersk Line's pulled this off, and to a certain extent, the U.S. Navy has been doing this for years and years. It's a whole concept called free cooling, which is kind of a misnomer. It's not quite free, but it's a free heat sink. And transferring heat to a water source, like even salt water, is pretty darn efficient. And anyone that goes out to sea typically uses the free cooling of the giant ocean heat sink to cool off their data plant or engines or passengers.
Right. Jason's got a YouTube video of the container data center in action. He's going to start it off at 257, which actually shows how they've been using these, exactly how they've been stacking. When you see the video, you can actually understand why people are making the jump to say that they're putting these containers on a container ship, because they look like that's what they're designed for. These things are self-contained modules that you can stack. I mean, that's what they were designed for, right? The containers were designed to be stacked on a container ship. So essentially, Google took containers off of a container ship. They turned them into a data center, and now they're putting them back on now that they've proven that the data center concept is sound. Let me go over to you, Curtis. One of the other interesting notes about this was the idea of being able to float a data center into international waters. Now, that sounds crazy, crazy far-fetched, but assuming they were able to overcome the technical challenges of getting power and connectivity out beyond the international waters line, what does that do for, say, the legality of a search and seizure that the government might do on data?
Well, realistically, it doesn't do a whole lot. Now, from a legal perspective, you get some interesting notions. And we've seen this tested with some of the offshore oil platforms up in the North Sea. People have put some servers up there, declared them sovereign nations, and decided that this made them essentially immune from search and seizure. Here's the big deal, though. The United States government has a navy. Google doesn't. And if it comes down to just going in to seize something that they really want to seize, without a great whopping large navy, you're not going to stop them. So I think that much of the discussion about parking servers in offshore waters is a flight of fancy. I think what we're seeing much more of is the idea that in areas where the real estate prices are very high, which are often coastal cities, New York, San Francisco, Tokyo, these sorts of places, being able to put a data center in a location where you're not paying for the ground under those servers makes a lot of economic sense. So I wouldn't be at all surprised if that's not what they're looking at, rather than anything where they're trying to protect data from through the prying eyes of established nations.
Right. The chat room called it out. That's the flight of fancy that the people who created Sealand were trying to do. You create a sovereign nation on one of the old radar installations from World War II, and you put a data center on top of it. You're exempt from laws, but at the same time, the cost of maintaining something so far out without access to the resources of an actual country, it's nothing more than a pipe dream. T-Bird, I want to give you the last word on this. Since you live on an island and you've done projects like this where you've turned ships into data centers, if Google does get this secret sauce, if they figure out a way to configure containers on land, load them up into barges, and float them to wherever they need, how soon before other major companies follow? Because we've seen the same thing happen when Google started making these data centers in a box. Microsoft, Sun, even Apple have all followed suit. How long do you expect to wait until other companies start saying, hey, this is a great idea, this is a good way to get free cooling and drop it exactly where our organization runs?
Yeah, I don't think it's so much the free cooling. You can get free cooling in the Pacific Northwest and all that kind of places. If you've ever dealt with the international trading community, these people are interested in every last stinking millisecond they can possibly get, down to the point where they don't use normal Ethernet. They use fiber channel to move their bits around. Now, what happens if you can take that barge full of machines ready to do international funds trading and put them halfway between New York and Tokyo? That's got to carve at least 30 or 40 milliseconds off the line. If they run it into the middle of the ocean and literally drop a connection into a suboceanic cable, now all of a sudden you can have 30, 40, 50, maybe even 60 milliseconds advantage over New York. And that's enough eternity as far as stock trading and funds trading.
Whoa. Okay, I had not even considered that angle. Not the last word, because now I want to go back to Curtis. Curtis, we talked about this story previously on Twiat, where you've got some financial companies who have sunk $3 billion, $4 billion into having their own transatlantic fiber run so that they can get to between the two exchanges and have just a little bit of an advantage to do their commodities and their currency exchange. If they're willing to drop $3 or $4 billion on their own private fiber run, don't you think they'd pay a few extra $100 million to put a container ship in the middle of the ocean with station keeping all the resources it needs in order to get even greater advantage when they're doing their trading?
Well, they could, but it's going to depend on exactly what's going on in that trading. I mean, if you put an actual trading floor in the middle of the ocean, that's one thing. You know, it's a very interesting set of circumstances where you're looking at also at that point, who gets the taxes from this? One of the dodges that Intel and a lot of other companies have used, when they figured out that for electronic parts, the components were being taxed at the point where the documents were signed transferring ownership, they started signing those documents in the captain's office on board the container ships in the middle of the Pacific. And it meant that a lot of equipment was transferred without taxes. It took a few years, but the countries on either end of that voyage figured out how to levy their taxes. So I think that we could at some point see trading floors in the middle of the Pacific, the middle of the Atlantic. But it's going to be a while. If you've ever been on a boat in the middle of the ocean, you know that if you were going to be there with anything like regular time, you'd want it to be one great whopping huge barge. Either that or you'd want to buy stock in Dramamine before you left.
Right. Now, I should mention that there are alternative theories as to what these container ships are. Some are saying that it's a retail space for Google. Others are saying that it could be a facility for Google Glass. Still others, one of my favorite theories is that this is an extension of what Sergey was saying about a place for people to test things, to just be tinkerers without the interference of government and without the interference of large corporations. I could imagine having one of these playgrounds, filling it up with the greatest tech, floating it out into international waters, and just letting a lot of really bright people go at it. But we'll see. I mean, I don't think the story is going to go away unless, of course, it sinks. Let's go on to the second enterprise bite. This one is actually a little bit scary. Netgear's very popular ReadyNAS line has a crazy, crazy, horrible, scary vulnerability in it that allows attackers to essentially do a command injection. Now, the flaw is in ReadyNAS's front view management interface. That's the firmware that runs everything that goes on inside of the array. It affects most modern versions of the ReadyNAS, from their prosumer to their enterprise models. That's all the way down from the NVX, which you would have in the small to medium business, all the way up to the 4500 series, which are those monster chassis with 12 drives that are, you know, crazy fast, 10 gigabit Ethernet interfaces. Any firmware prior to 4.2.24 is vulnerable to this command line injection. Now, FrontView fails to sanitize user input. As long as it looks like an HTTP command, it will let it through, and that's where the problem lies. This allows attackers to execute commands on the integrated Apache web server and on the kernel that lies within the embedded Linux. Attackers can gain root access, and that allows them to look at the data on the arrays, to modify passwords, to add users. And here's the really, really scary part. I actually tested this over the weekend. It allows users to add to what was the flexibility of the platform, which was plugins. You can add a plugin to do, say, photo sharing or to do VPN. Over the weekend, I was able to use this attack to add a plugin that was essentially a penetration testing tool. Now, I didn't put a lot of time. I just pulled a few things off of Metasploit and slammed it together, but it ran beautifully. Essentially, what this means is that someone accessing a publicly facing ReadyNAS could put a Trojan horse inside of the network. They could run a plugin on the ReadyNAS. They could cover it over so you don't know it's running, and it could be doing all the penetration testing behind the firewall. Chibert, let me throw this over to you. We both have used ReadyNASs in the past. In fact, I have an unpatched ReadyNAS. I'm now using it for testing out this vulnerability. How scary is this for enterprises that might be using one of the large boxes?
It's horribly scary. The thing is, though, you really ought not to be running one of these in a public-facing address space. I don't dare put one of these into the wild. I'll put every single one behind a firewall. The unfortunate fact of life is our friends at ReadyNAS, while Inferent and ReadyNAS did an absolutely spectacular job on the firmware, it hasn't kept up. They haven't paid a lot of attention to the new vulnerabilities that are coming out. They haven't added a lot of features. They still can't do SNMP v3 yet. There's no v6, or if it's there, it's really weak. The firewall features haven't kept up. There's a lot of things that Netgear haven't done. And so it's almost like they've been standing still. So unfortunately, I can no longer give the ReadyNAS line a buy recommendation. Instead, that's started to go to Synology.
Yeah, I'm actually the exact same way. You know that I was a big proponent of ReadyNAS. I was with them when they were Inferent. I love the gear. I love the fact that they had a really strong user community so that even if the company wasn't supporting a feature, you could probably get a community of geeks together to write a module or to fix a problem. That seems to have gone away in the past, I'd say, year, maybe even less than a year, the last 9 months. You've really lost a lot of the user interest. Netgear has made some really anti-enterprise, anti-consumer moves, trying to get people to buy the new arrays rather than supporting the old ones. And now this was such a critical vulnerability. They knew it was a critical vulnerability, and yet they didn't make it a priority. They didn't inform their customers that they really should patch it. In fact, the only note that this is a problem is if you look at the update for 4.2.24, there's a tiny little line that says security vulnerability update. Doesn't explain what it is. Doesn't explain that, yes, you really need to do this. Curtis, let me go over to you. We know that confidence in a product is fleeting, and especially now, if you've got a security issue and companies don't feel as if you're forthright, they don't feel that you've done everything you can to protect their data, you're basically done, right? I mean, it's very difficult to recover from something like that.
Well, if you're selling into the enterprise market, it certainly is. I think what we're seeing here that's very interesting is a growing number of companies that seem to not explicitly care about the enterprise market, even though they may, in some cases, be used within the enterprise. You know, to some extent, people have been talking about Apple this way a lot. We have Google playing both sides of the street, and now a company like this, with their ReadyNAS box, making decisions and acting in ways that are absolutely antithetical to enterprise thinking. It's hard to know whether they've decided that the legitimate, straight-up enterprise market makes up such a small percentage of their customer base that they're just not going to worry about them, or they've decided that the pull of the customer, the consumer, is so great that they can behave any way they want, and they're going to be brought into the enterprise anyway by people who just plain ignore the recommendations of their enterprise IT people. If it's the second of those, then this is not only scary, it's irresponsible. If you want to say, we're not going into the enterprise, we don't recognize that the enterprise should have any interest in us, that's one thing. That's fair warning to the enterprise people. If, on the other hand, you're saying, you know what? We know that your employees are going to bring us in there, and there's not a darn thing you can do about it. That's a different scale of problem, and I fear we're dealing with more of that than the other.
Oh, that's actually a little bit sad. Chibert, let me throw back to you really quickly, because you mentioned something at the very beginning of your bit, and that was you never saw a need to have one of these things publicly facing, because that's essentially what we're talking about, a publicly facing ReadyNAS. But more and more of these devices were built with features that could only be accessible if it was publicly facing. I think this is one of the things that really started to turn the ReadyNAS community against Netgear, and that was when they took security and they put it in a back door to making really cool, nifty gadgets and nifty apps. This isn't compatible with enterprise mentality, right?
No, not at all. you know, just as a systems analyst, I will never put storage in a publicly facing interface, period. I'll always put a proxy of some sort. Now, if our friends at Netgear had decided, okay, we're going to have an appliance that's a proxy for this, then that makes a whole lot of sense. But they didn't. There, like you said, there's a whole bunch of things that they've designed in so that you have one interface of the rating as facing the public and one interface facing the private. And they're expecting the rating as to be able to play firewall for that. And it's not a good firewall at all. In fact, it's a really brain dead firewall. So it really makes me wonder what they're thinking, because it certainly isn't a good plan.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, I don't want to pile on Netgear too much, because I actually still like the ReadyNAS platform. I think it's very flexible. I think there is a lot to be said for it, but I think we can all agree that there have been some moves as of late, or inactivity as of late, that really makes it so that we can't recommend it to any of our SOHO or enterprise viewers. Now, when we come back, we're going to be talking all about identity management. You may have forgotten what it's about, but we haven't. We're going to tell you why it's important right after Qbert clears his throat. But before we do that, let's take a moment to talk about one of the Twiat Riot sponsors, and that's RingCentral. That's right. When we built this brick house, Leo decided that we wanted to show our audience that we weren't afraid to dog food. We wanted to do everything in the cloud. We wanted our calendaring, our email, our services, our doc sharing, everything possible in the cloud to be in the cloud. That's why when our IT guy Russell came to us and told us that we could have a full-featured PBX phone system without any of the traditional muss and fuss, well, it was a no-brainer. We love RingCentral. There are zero startup costs. There's no PBX hardware to install or maintain. Our producers can get their voicemail in their email, and we can even get all of our fax messages right on our smartphones, all within a system that doesn't require extra wiring, no bulky hardware in the basement, no dedicated manager to make sure that everything works when we need it to work. It's just that simple. RingCentral also offers call functioning. You get to program the order of device that will ring when someone calls your number, like, for example, to your desk phone, then to your smartphone, so that you never miss an important business opportunity again. You can even choose the amount of rings before the call goes to the next device. So here's what we'd like you to do. We want you to see if you're going to enjoy, if you'll find as productive RingCentral as we do here at the Twit Brick House. RingCentral offers all-inclusive pricing as low as $20 per month per user. You can start right now with a 30-day risk-free trial, and they have a special offer for my listeners. When you buy one desk phone, you get a second phone free, up to 20 phones. So call this number, designated for my listeners, 800-543-9980. That's 800-543-9980. Again, one more time, just in case the call is going through Google's barge, 800-543-9980. Or you can go to ringcentral.com and use the promo code TWIT. That's ringcentral.com, promo code TWIT. And we thank RingCentral for their support of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Now let's get into a bit of a deep dive. We're talking all about identity management, which is... Actually, I kind of forget what it is. Qbert, remind me, what is identity management again? Why did we originally talk about it, and why has it fallen out of the public consciousness?
Well, actually, identity management is one of those things. We use it all the time for Active Directory. But the concept is having some sort of X500-type directory system that you can store authentication information, you can store contact information, you can store a lot of different things in it. So way back when, I think it was, I want to say 2005, 2006, at InfoWorld, we actually ran a monster identity management. So the whole concept was we had a fictitious company called Fergenschmeyer Enterprises, and it was merging with TCPIP.com. And so the whole concept was called When Harry Met Sally. Harry goes and meets Sally Fergenschmeyer. They fall in love. They get married. They have kids, and then Harry gets busted trying to break into the system. Sally divorces Harry and everything. But the whole concept was how it changed, how the identity management system would go and change Harry's rights, change Sally's rights, change Sally's identity to become, you know, you know, Harry's wife and so forth and so on. But it is the center of the world for large enterprises because flat file authentication systems like, you know, maybe the shadow files on Linux do not scale. But having a database-driven authentication system makes a lot more sense and has become part and parcel with every major corporation, whether it be LDAP, whether it be Novell's eDirectory, whether it be Active Directory, or some variation thereof. In fact, it's so popular that even Microsoft's Active Directory has a Radius shim that can be put on top of it. So it has become the center of the enterprise. So anyway, there's lots of different things, but one of the things, the reason why we've stopped seeing a lot about identity management as a separate subject is it has become so much a part of the enterprise that things like the winner of our shootout that you can see here when Harry met Sally, Thor Systems actually got bought by Oracle. In fact, Thor actually got bought even before our identity management shootout was done. So that was kind of unique. And then, of course, Microsoft has stopped calling it identity management and just called it part and parcel Active Directory. So a lot of really cool things. And the center of the enterprise has scaled bigger and bigger. You can now have your identity management system, your directory system, scaled all over the world. In fact, that's one of the things that we're going to talk about just a shade later when we start talking about Azure. So Microsoft has actually taken the concept of Active Directory and put it into the cloud and added some really cool new tools.
Nice, nice, nice. Now, I want to go over to you, Curtis, because I think we have your video back. Identity management was a big topic not too long ago. In fact, this article that Chiebert's referring to was co-authored by our very own Oliver Rist, and it was a really, really exciting topic for enterprise, this idea that you could have a single database that follows a user around that can escalate or de-escalate their privileges as required. But then it just kind of, it went away. We stopped talking about identity management. It stopped being a big ticket item. It stopped being a big feature that people were pushing. Is that because no one really cares about it? Or are we seeing it being integrated into more and more products and it's just now a cost of doing business?
Well, I think there's an extent to which it's dealing with the consequences of its own success. Looked at another way, parking lots are important pieces of the infrastructure for most companies, but you don't see huge discussions going on about the quality of different asphalt mixtures. It's not that they're not important. It's not that people don't appreciate them. They're just such a piece of what's going on that people depend on the experts to take care of it. You could say that identity management has had that same thing. I think it's fascinating because in a very real way, this is the core battle for the mind, heart, and soul of the enterprise. Microsoft wants it. Oracle wants it. To be brutally honest, I think we'll know that Google is serious about the enterprise when Google rolls out their own identity management system. But because two or three companies or two or three solutions, because we'll include Radius, which isn't a company but a technology, have captured so much of the marketplace, we're not seeing a lot of the innovative, smaller solutions that we were seeing a few years ago. At this point, people either work with, on top of, or through one of the majors, and they allow those major identity management systems to control the directory, to control the identity of all the users. I'm looking forward to Brian's discussion of Azure in just a minute, because as he points out, that's really a step in taking identity management beyond the walls of the enterprise and into the wider world. That's a place we're going to see it going more and more. And believe me, while executives want it to work, they really, truly don't want to know what goes on under the covers.
All right. I want to step just a little bit back to break this down for our audience members who maybe aren't getting all the techno speak, maybe aren't getting all the buzzwords. I think at its very simplest core, identity management is the ability to have a single database of all your users. And that could be in the tens, in the hundreds, in the thousands, or in the case of some of the larger providers, in the millions. And in that database, you have the permissions that they're supposed to have. If I work for Corporation X and I work in Department Y, it can say, well, he should have this permission, this permission, this permission, but not these. And if I switch to another department within that corporation, it should automatically switch me to the resources that I should have access to. It's really the only thing that works for large scale networks, because you can't always be going through, as Chiebert mentioned, the shadow list to manually determine who should have access to what. It also is great if you ever change policies across the entire enterprise. If you suddenly decide that everyone from Division A should be able to share resources with people from Division B, it's easier to make one command rather than 10,000. Now, Chiebert, let me go back to you, because Curtis made a very interesting remark, and that was about identity management being, sort of below the covers, underneath all the layers that we see, and that Google is actually a big player. Believe it or not, there was a big identity management push with Microsoft's Windows 8 strategy. Everything from Windows Phone to their tablet to Windows 8 tried to get us to log in to Microsoft's, what do they call it, live service. I'm kind of blanking on the name right now. People balked. People didn't like that. People really hated being forced to do that. And yet that was one of the biggest features, the ability to have your profiles move from one device to the next, your permissions from one server to the next seamlessly. Why is it that people balked at Microsoft doing it, but when you look at, say, Google Accounts, which gives you access to your email, to your applications, to your drive, that seems to be just fine?
I don't know. A lot of it is probably, you know, the concept of, ooh, who's the evil empire? The other thing, actually, there's kind of an associated bitch, shall we say, that a lot of corporations have, and that previously with the whole concept of Microsoft Active Directory, every Active Directory account used to be a CAL. And when you start talking about, even on a volume license, maybe you get a CAL down to $10, $15, but when you're talking about millions of people, that's a heck of a lot of money. So one of the things that's changed, and I've actually got the URL in the doc, is that Microsoft has now made Active Directory in the cloud a free feature of Azure. There's a whole bunch of new features within Azure that you can get for free, and that's kind of a cool thing. So now you can actually run another free utility called DirSync, and you can actually synchronize your local Active Directory with the cloud so that instead of having to come all the way back, say, to Minnesota to authenticate, you can actually authenticate against the Azure cloud. Now, Google's tried to do the same thing, but the Google solution, in order to synchronize with your local directory service for your enterprise, it's kind of painful. And so as a result, you know, people are going, oh, is this really worth it? And previously, one of the reasons why I really looked hard at Google was because they're offering a multi-factor authentication. Well, as part of the Azure system, part of that whole ecosystem, Microsoft is saying, well, you can have multi-factor authentication, and, oh, by the way, we're going to support all of them. They're actually starting to, in fact, even at Microsoft Corporate, they're starting to use a lot more of putting credentials into TPM chips onto laptops and desktops. In the Microsoft multi-factor authentication, it'll actually send a message to your smartphone or regular phone, and that's your second factor authentication. So it's kind of cool, and they're taking it so that it's no longer just bound up to a single enterprise, but they're spreading it out on the cloud. And I think that's what's causing a lot of excitement.
Okay. Now let's go to the enterprise side. Curtis, Microsoft has made a lot of missteps as of late, but what Chiebert's talking about with the change of Azure pricing, with the change of Active Directory pricing, it seems as if Microsoft is finally understanding that maybe this is part of their new strategy of not having their individual divisions competing against each other, but pulling them into the Microsoft ecosystem, giving them something of value, and then maybe letting them spread out to all the other services that they offer. We know that this works with consumers. We've seen it work at Google. We've seen it work at Yahoo. We've seen Apple do it. Can Microsoft make the same transition?
I think Microsoft can make the transition, and they've done a genius thing with the pricing, and that's that they've gotten the CFO involved in the discussion. If it were being talked about simply on a technology level, then you have a lot of people who can do one of two things. Either say, I really know this other solution much better. Let's stay with it because I know how to make it work. Or they would say, well, you know, in this particular feature, the alternative is better, and therefore we should stay with the alternative. Now you've got the financial people going, well, just how much better is that solution? If it's not a lot better, we're going to go with free because of the pricing. And just how much would it cost to retrain our people because we're paying X hundreds of thousands of dollars a year in licensing for another solution? We can get it for free from Microsoft. Microsoft has brought the right people into the enterprise discussion. And I think because of that, they're going to see many more of their customers deciding that they're going to go ahead and take the leap into both Active Directory and the cloud. And between you and me, if they do both of those, then it pretty much guarantees they're going to be in the Microsoft camp for a long, long time to come.
Got it. Cheever, let me ask you that question. How does Microsoft compete with free? Identity management is important, but you know, you've got companies like Google that are doing identity management, maybe not in the best way possible, but they're doing it at an acceptable price point, and they're doing it well enough.
I think Google's kind of interesting in that they want you in their ecosystem, and it's not as flexible as everybody really thinks it is. It's a good system, don't get me wrong, but if you need to have a connection between the Google authentication system and, say, Active Directory, there's still quite a few hoops to jump through. One of the things that we're going to cover when we start getting into the slides that I get to share from the Microsoft Reviewers Workshop that I was at, Microsoft has gone a bit further with a concept called federation. They're no longer saying you have to only be in a Microsoft environment. The federation server and the multi-factor authentication server have the ability to tie you in, so that if you have devices that are Radius only or TACAX only or LDAP only, it will provide an interface for you. And not only that, you can apply business rules to how that interface is provided. And the whole concept of federation starts becoming a lot more real. People have been wanting to do federation for a long, long time, but the tools were cumbersome and inadequate. So say, for instance, if Walmart Corporation wanted to give their buyers or have their buyers be able to get into Bob's toilet paper company so that they can place orders directly into the order entry system, that used to be a lot of custom programming. Now it's not. So I think it's going to be federation and the fact that Microsoft is no longer saying you have to only be in the Microsoft world. I think that's the exciting part. And I think that's where Google is going to have to play catch up on.
I like that. We're going to be talking all about that, specifically going into federation, going into these Active Directory extensions to talk about why a solution like this designed for the enterprise might be better than free. But before that, Jason, why don't we show our viewers what they missed if they haven't been watching TWiT all this last week?
Previously on TWiT, TWiT Live Specials.
Today we think we have the biggest step yet in delivering the vision that is iPad, that it deserves a new name.
iPad Air. All right, does anybody have that in their bingo card?
Nobody.
Nobody.
Frame rate.
Netflix had a very positive earnings report. Among other things, they now have 31 million subscribers in the United States. That's more subscribers than HBO.
I'm sorry, it sounded as though you said more subscribers than more than HBO.
OMG Craft.
1.7 is here. You've been waiting. New features. It's like a whole new Minecraft.
Triangulation.
Your name, Lava Bit, was tied with Edward Snowden. When were you first approached by the U.S. government?
I was approached in May. I just was so taken aback by their scope and what they were demanding that I felt I had to shut down as a result of that complaint.
Gizwiz.
Next people that go by, I'm going to scare them.
Chocolate bars for the poor. Any? Yeah, I don't know.
TWiT, now also available in several colors of unapologetic plastic.
And thanks to all the Twit crew who makes all that programming possible. Now, let's get back to it. Chibrit, we've been talking a little bit about the theory of identity management. And on the surface, it's a good idea. This idea of the singular database that follows you around, that gives you permissions, that gives you access to the resources that you're supposed to have. But how does it actually work? How do we actually integrate it? What should IT managers and IT professionals know about, let's specifically talk about Microsoft's abilities to push identity management into the enterprise?
Well, first and foremost, Microsoft's current message is federation. You know, directory services are fine, but the world doesn't revolve around a single database. And that's what Microsoft's really trying to get people to see. The concept of federation is that we're able to go and provide links to other clouds, other databases, other pools of identity, and give limited access and limited transportability between the two databases while able to apply business rules. It has been kind of the golden egg, the goal of a lot of people. They wanted federation. Federation has been something that people wanted forever and ever. So it's things like, in a great example, when I was playing with Microsoft Link, the federation interface in Link allowed you to create links to, say, other corporations. And instead of giving you access to the entire company directory, it only gave you access to a limited amount of presence information so that I could go and say, is the person available for a chat? And by applying business rules, I could say, well, I can only see visibility 9 to 5. After that, I'm sorry. It also means that if I'm busy, only send it to a recording or only send it to email. So federation is basically the ability to link multiple pools of authentication, multiple pools of identity, but by being able to apply business rules. And when you start looking at the slide that's on the screen, Microsoft is starting to provide the tools. So it's no longer identity management only for Windows machines. I was actually playing with the identity management on iOS 6. iOS 7 is going to be any day now. Android is on its way. It's in beta testing now. Mac OS, OS X, all works. So it's no longer just a Windows world. If you have a mobile device, you can all play. And one of the first things that they did was they actually handed us Surface RTs, so the less expensive machine. And we did, for the first time, played with Windows 8.1 and a concept called a workgroup join. So instead of having to do a full Active Directory login, I can use the Federation server so that I can do a light login. So it might give me access only to certain web pages, so software as a service or something. And it provides that control point so that I can still apply business rules to it. It is a sweeping change in the way you can do business and be cooperative between businesses.
Right. Okay. So let me go over to you, Curtis. We've seen promises like this before. But there are a lot of other competitors in this business. Oracle's trying to give us a really strong identity management solution as well. What, in your mind, makes Microsoft a more interesting sell or a different sell than Oracle?
I think that Microsoft's sell is a little more interesting because of their breadth in the enterprise. Oracle is still, by and large, a back-end database and enterprise apps case. They sell those apps. They sell the hardware on which you run them. Microsoft has everything from the infrastructure pieces, Active Directory, through the back-end OS and applications right through to the client pieces. To me, that makes them a far more interesting play for this. You know, one of the interesting concepts, and I've been thinking about it a lot as I've listened to Brian talk, in the world of sales, when you're talking about selling with a partner, one of the big questions is who's going to own the customer? You know, you can sell a piece and your partner can sell a piece and maybe this other company can sell a piece. But who is the customer going to call when they want to order more of everything? Who's going to be that primary contact? And I think to a greater and greater extent, companies like Microsoft are seeing user identity and identity management as being the piece that allows them to own the customer. A lot of people want to own the customer. From an enterprise perspective, you could make a case for Microsoft, for Oracle, for SAP, and even to a growing extent for Google. A couple of weeks ago when we were at Gartner, Eric Schmidt talked about that in very direct terms. Google wants to be an enterprise play. In order to do that, they've got to figure out how to own the customer. And identity management is the most certain way to do that from top to bottom. Microsoft is ahead of the rest. It's going to be really interesting to see what sort of incentives the other companies can come up with to beat Microsoft's ubiquity and, starting with their new licensing scheme, their price.
All right. Chibert, let's go to a little bit of brass tacks here. Let's say I am convinced and I want to buy into Microsoft's federation. I want to use this as the control point for all of my services, for all of my users. What are the things that I have to do to build this into my enterprise? Let's say I've got a 10,000 seat corporation. It's our mythical 10,000 seat. And it's a crazy hodgepodge of devices and services. It's definitely BYOD. I've got things from Apple. I've got things from Microsoft. I've got Android devices in my network. I have database products from Oracle, and I have permissions that need to be set for workers in office, at remote offices, and working from home. How do I set up Federation and Microsoft Active Directory to be able to sync all those permissions across the different locations into the cloud?
So in a Microsoft world, you'd be running locally your Active Directory at your corporate office. You would put Active Directory Azure in the cloud. You'd go and do a directory sync or Active Directory Federation services so that it would sync between your enterprise and your the cloud presence. Now, the cool thing is you can also use a Microsoft Intune that allow you to go and manage your mobile devices, not just remote wipe, but also push out application portals, push out permissions, push out patches, and so forth, that gives you more ability to control the remote sites. And because it's in the cloud, it allows you to do this without a huge, huge investment. In fact, a lot of the prototype you can do just in the free version of Microsoft Azure. And that's actually one of the things that I'm taking a good hard look at, because my sister-in-law came up with this great idea. She wants to create a database where elementary school kids can go out and register the old folks, grandma and grandpa, go and get them to register saying, hey, I'm homebound, I'm wheelchair bound, I don't walk so great, I need to be evacuated early in case of tsunamis. And that's kind of a cool thing. So we're going to try and put that into the cloud and make it cheaper to do multi-factor authentication so that the first responders can securely get to this database and we don't create a huge problem with spreading people's personally identifiable information all over creation.
Got it. Curtis, let me go over to you again, because we do have another enterprise angle on this, because I know there are still going to be people who are saying, our authentication server works fine. We've got a solution from X, SAP, Oracle, IBM. We're using Google in the cloud. One of the things that's unique about Microsoft's new solutions is how bidirectional they are, how they will sync up permissions. It's not the old, I've got one server that's authoritative and it pushes out permissions to everything else. You really can have this sort of shared responsibility for who's supposed to have what resources, what permissions. Is that, I understand why that's better on the geek side, but from the executive side, do we want that? Isn't the enterprise more attuned to having that one authoritative source of who should have access to what?
Well, I think the enterprise likes the idea of having one authoritative source, but they're willing to believe that the one authoritative source is their IT department rather than a particular server. What the enterprise really wants today is the ability to put critical information in the hands of people who are having an encounter with the customer whenever and wherever they need it. And if the case can be made that in order to better put that information in the hands of someone who has a tablet, a smartphone, a laptop, or even web access from a customer computer, that the best way to do that is by sharing the information amongst servers that belong to you, that are sitting in the cloud, that are shared by a trusted partner. This makes things easier. Executives are going to buy that, because when you talk to executives, whether it be CIOs, CMOs, or CEOs, what they really want is to enhance the customer encounter. And they know that their employees have to have information in order to do that. And they're willing for their IT department to do whatever they need to do to make that happen.
I like that. Anything you need to do to make it happen. Chibert, there is one more thing. It's been floating around the chat room a little bit, and I just received a couple of tweets about it. They want to know about how this new paradigm of Active Directory with Federation services also counts for RADIUS and LDAP and all the other identity management schemes. I know that this is supposed to encompass that, and I know that it uses that nice little triangle of delegation. But exactly how does Microsoft account for currently multiple identity management systems being in use? I mean, am I going to have to re-enter all of my my users? Am I going to have to recreate a new database? Exactly what is Microsoft proposing?
Okay, so actually I should probably answer Java 678 first. That Federation is not particularly a Unix term. It is used by the Unix world, and Federation is, you know, kind of the goal for a lot of directory systems. However, the Microsoft world has the ability through the multi-factor authentication server to be able to link and synchronize multiple authentication sources. So you can actually push and pull from the RADIUS world, from the TACACS world, from the open LDAP world, and so forth. Microsoft is trying to be non-platform specific here. It obviously has a big Microsoft leaning, but the servers are there. It's gotten to the point where Microsoft has actually gone and worked directly with people like Linus Torvalds, and there is Microsoft code or Microsoft portions of code in the Linux kernel now. So that gives you superb Linux support in Hyper-V. It also gives you more support for identity management and gives you more support for remote management with things like Microsoft Intune. Basically, what Microsoft's doing is saying, hey, you know we're not the only thing out there. We're going to provide ways of working with them. And in many cases, we're going to start donating pieces of our code into the open source world so that we can make it a bit, you know, make you part of our world and us part of your world. In fact, the Microsoft management, I think it's called OMI now, is actually an open standard, so that from the Microsoft System Center, you can actually manage directly VMware, you can manage portions of Citrix, you can manage parts of OpenStack, you can even manage Linux clusters. So the world is homogenizing in a way, even though we still have a heterogeneous world.
So essentially what you're saying is one identity management to rule them all.
Yeah, funny boy.
I like it. I like it. Curtis, let me go to you for one last bit, one last look at the enterprise side of this. Again, sounds good. And we're actually asking a Microsoft AD and Federation Services expert to come on and show us exactly how this works, how you would migrate to their service. But is there ROI here? Do you see it? I mean, if I'm running a 10,000 seat enterprise, my IAM is probably working just fine. It may not be the greatest thing ever. It may not have as much flexibility. It may not be able to migrate my authentication from device to device, from platform to platform. But Is this a big enough of a paradigm shift where I'm going to look at this as a CTO or a CFO and say, yes, the amount of money that we have to spend to train people in this, to move over to the system is going to be worth it because we see value add down the road?
I can think of two big areas in which they might do that. One is purely financial. As we've said before, Microsoft has come in with a nearly unbeatable price point. If they can provide an absolutely rock-solid, secure solution at a price of free, then that's a compelling argument when used against all of those identity management solutions that still require a per-seat license renewed per year. The other comes about in what executives want to do with their enterprise. Right now, you're hearing an awful lot of executives talk about how they want their enterprise to be agile and dynamic. Quick moving, quick response, turn on a dime, move out to address the customer. If someone in the IT department can make the case that by moving their identity management into the new Microsoft paradigm, that they can help enhance the capabilities for all of these buzzwords that basically mean making it easier for our employees to have a quality encounter with the customer, then that provides enough ROI for a lot of executives to write the check for the training, write the check for the rehosting, write the check for the migration in the hopes that it's going to give them a competitive advantage with their customers in the coming years.
Chivert, last word goes to you. What is one thing that you really want people to know about identity management? I know it's been integrated into a lot of the services that they use just on a daily basis, but it's starting to make more waves as we see Microsoft moving into the cloud, as we see them trying to do this cloud slash colo slash private network solution. It's coming back to the forefront. So what should people know about identity management in the next, say, 3 years?
I want people to really know about identity management as it's not just authentication. In fact, there's some movements. I've actually started to see some alpha code from some security companies where instead of having a dedicated standalone database for things like card key systems, they're now integrating it into Active Directory or LDAP. So this starts getting be interesting because it also brings in yet another ring of the enterprise, and that's security event management. So long ago, we did a SEM test. I believe Curtis was involved in that. And the idea is, gee, wouldn't it be cool if you can do wider correlation? So if someone does a VPN, say, from Germany into Milwaukee, but at the within the same hour does a card swipe for physical access as separate events, those are no big deal. But together, that is one heck of a security breach because that means someone's physical credentials or VPN credentials have been stolen. So as we start getting more and more standards for pieces to talk to each other, we're going to start seeing security become better and easier to implement so that even things like physical and data security can start combining together.
Well, and the next time we bring up this topic, we're going to be, again, with a actual expert of Microsoft services. So we'll be able to talk about all the advantages and disadvantages. And I did promise a few guys in the chat room that within the next 3 months, we will have an Oracle expert on the show just to give us another view of maybe a different way to do your IM. But alas, you've done it again. You've used up another hour listening to the best dang enterprise podcast hosted by a Catholic priest at 12 o'clock on Mondays. That's right, I checked, it's true. But you know what? We don't want to send you away empty-handed. We do want you to, first of all, make sure that you check out our show page at twit.tv/twiet. There you'll be able to find all the different ways that you can get our show downloaded into your device of choice automatically each and every single week. That's right. You want it on your iPad, on your iPhone. We know you want it on your Android tablet or phone. We know you want it downloaded into your Windows, your Mac, PC, or maybe even onto your Zombie Zune. Well, we've had our smart guys here coding all the different ways that you can get our episodes, be it audio, video, high-quality video, in your devices when you need it. You want to listen to us on the drive home? We can do that. You want to listen to us on the large screen TV at home so you can get some enterprise goodness as you're winding down the day? Well, we can do that too. It's just one of the things that we do for everyone in the Twilight Riot. Also, you can find us at our YouTube page at youtube.com/Twilight. There you'll be able to find not only our shows, but the individual learning segments, the ones that are so popular. Stuff My IT Guy Says. You want to learn about wireless. You want to learn about tapping. You want to learn about topics and issues in IT that maybe you're a little too embarrassed to ask someone about because you should already know it. Well, it's all in there at youtube.com/Twilight. Also, you can follow me on Twitter at twitter.com/PadreSJ. There you'll be able to find out what we're doing each week on the show, and you'll be able to keep up with the life of the Digital Jesuit, even suggesting topics for future shows. In fact, I'd say a good half of the shows over the next 2 months came straight from the chat room and for topics that were suggested on my Twitter account. Finally, you can join us live here every week, Mondays at noon, here in the Brick House in Petaluma. We do the show, and if you come early, you get to see how the sausage is made. You get to watch the pre-show and the post-show, all the things that don't go into the final mix. It's one of those things that makes Twit just a little different. And as long as you're into the whole different thing, why not join us in our chat room at irc.twit.tv. There you'll be able to join us in real time. You'll hear Chibert and Curtis and I occasionally pulling comments out of the chat room. Well, we talk to some of the brightest people, some of the funniest trolls, and yes, some of the most loyal listeners and watchers of Twit TV. I want to thank my expert panel. It's always great to have you guys on. Chibert, tell the Twit Riot a little bit about what you're doing, what they should know about, and where they can find you next.
Well, I've got a bunch of articles that are coming out on InfoWorld, and if all goes well, I might actually start be putting some hardware, more hardware-oriented reviews up on Tom's IT Hardware. Ooh. But before I leave, I wanted to go throw a note out to Eric Duckman and some of the other folks, and it's me, and saying one of the big disadvantages of Active Directory or any directory system is time sync. So as a teaser for the future, one of the things we're going to do on a someday maker show is I'm going to show how to build an open source NTP server.
Ooh. Oh, okay. Let's do the time sync again. Show title. Now, we had a teaser at the top of the show from our very own Curtis Franklin. Curtis, what is this thing that you want us to all pay attention to?
Well, Padre, tomorrow, that's Tuesday, October 29th, 2 p.m., we're going to do an episode of E2 Radio that's a little bit different. We're talking about a management topic, but we're going to be talking about the importance of two little words in management. Those two words, thank you. We've got someone who has done something special with their life regarding saying thank you to people who don't hear it very often. We're going to be talking about how managers can use thank you a little bit more to get the results they like a little bit more. I would love it if some of the Twilight crew would come on over. That's Tuesday, October 29th, 2 p.m. Join us. Leave your comments. Let us know how you feel about thank you and the importance of saying those two little words when it comes to IT management.
I love it. Speaking of the importance of thank you to everyone here who makes this show possible, to Carson, my super producer, and yes, to my TD. He's really the fourth member of the panel because he's the guy who makes everything go, Mr. Jason Howell behind the TD desk. Now, Jason, I do this bit every week, but it never gets old for me, and that is I hear that we've got a show here on the Twit TV network. That's right. Right here that talks about Android. In fact, it's like a lot of things about Android.
That's what it's called, a lot of Android.
A lot of Android. Okay, and where can I... Well,
tweaking the title.
Yeah, tweak it a little bit. Yeah. But let's say you were hosting this a lot of Android. Where would I find it?
Twit.tv/AAA for a lot about Android.
I don't like that. Let's tweak that.
Yeah, okay. Well, there you go. All about Android, twit.tv/AAA every Tuesday at 5 p.m. Pacific live. at live.twit.tv. If you have to, you know, catch it live, there you go.
There you go. I mean, best dang Android show in the universe. That one, shucks. I did check. Okay, thanks again to you. And next week, we've got a special treat. We've got Joe Habib from Wild Packets. He'll be coming back on to show us all about application performance monitoring. You may remember him from a wonderful Wi-Fi demo just a few weeks ago. Well, we've got him back to show you the skivvy on what you can do to speed up your network. I'm Father Robert Ballester, and I want to remind you that if you want to know what's going on in the enterprise, just keep quiet.